Like a lot of other cities, Pittsburgh has to deal with its antiquated lead water lines. The state says so. But how?
It won't get better. The long-term solution is to completely remove lead pipes from our water system.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, the mayor, the money, and the lead problem in Pittsburgh's drinking water. Plus, a summer job program gets kids out into an underserved community to talk to residents about lead exposure.
I'm not going to lie. I knew about some of the dangers of lead, but not really into too depth. So it's like cool going home to my mom like, I know this.
And the great eclipse is almost upon us. What you'll see and what you won't. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Two environmental groups have scored a legal victory in an ongoing challenge to the expansion of an underground coal mine. It's already the nation's largest. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports the Sierra Club and the Center for Coalfield Justice are fighting permits for the Bailey Mine Complex in Greene County.
The State Environmental Hearing Board ruled in the group's favor, finding that the Department of Environmental Protection violated Pennsylvania's Clean Streams Law and the Environmental Rights Amendment when it authorized the mine operator, CONSOL, to cause extensive damage to a stream flowing into Ryerson Station State Park. Veronica Coptis heads the Center for Coalfield Justice.
And this ruling really puts the industry and DEP on notice that it has to do a better job of developing mining plans in the future to protect streams.
The board denied a second appeal by the environmental groups. CONSOL and DEP officials say they are still reviewing the ruling. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Pittsburgh has reinvented itself as a hub for tech firms like Google and Uber. But it's also mired in an effort to replace a system of lead pipes laid down many decades ago. The city's water authority just halted part of its effort to replace thousands of lead service lines because it was actually making the problem worse. Pittsburgh is under a state mandate to replace its lead service lines because of the dangerous health impacts of lead exposure, especially for children. But it faces a stack of legal, technical, and financial hurdles to do it. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports that it looks like there's no quick fix for solving the problem.
A work crew is digging down below a narrow street in Pittsburgh. The crew has been at it for an hour or so, first using a backhoe to dig through layers of asphalt, cement, and clay. 5 feet below street level, Mark McClafferty is now using a shovel as he uncovers one last scoop of dirt before finding what the crew has been looking for.
Lead!
He sees the telltale sign of lead pipes, large round lumps where different sections of pipe join together, almost like the pipes are swollen.
It's round. That's when they heat it up and melt the lead together. Anything else would have a nut on it.
Each water line into a house has two parts. One part is owned by the water authority, and the other by the property owner. The crew has found a line with lead on both sides, the city's and the homeowner's. In that case, the city won't replace its half of the line, says Manda Metzger, an engineer with the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority, or PWSA.
So we just backfill it and leave it until, you know, we either coordinate with the homeowner if they prefer to change their line. Otherwise, we can't. Do a partial replacement.
Since failing its lead test last year, the Water Authority has been under state mandate to replace 7% of its lead lines a year. Until June, the Water Authority had been doing partial replacements, replacing public lead pipes but not private ones. But just doing one side of the service line can actually make the problem worse, says Bob Weimar, interim executive director of the PWSA. Weimar says there's a coating inside the pipes that keeps lead from getting into water. Construction can jostle some of that coating, and it can break off.
Basically, you could say that it's similar to what happens in a stream when you have a rainstorm, a heavy rainstorm, and it washes away debris that might have collected in the stream.
When the authority has replaced only its side of the lead service lines, lead levels have spiked. One home had a reading nearly 100 times the federal action level for lead. For the hundreds of homes where there have been partial line replacements, the authority is recommending residents flush their water lines before using them for drinking and use pitcher-style lead filters. Corey Riddle went a step further.
Down below here, this is like the reserve tank, and it's got three filtration systems, so it's kind of nice because it's constantly filtering water and cleaning itself.
Riddle and his roommate installed a $200 water treatment system under their kitchen sink when they first heard there may be lead in the water last year. Then the city did a partial lead line replacement on his street a few months ago. His lead removal system keeps his water clean, but he's frustrated that he and his roommate had to install the system just to get clean water.
It's pretty lousy, to be honest. Kind of the half-baked effort, if you will, of just replacing half of it and increasing lead content.
He knows removing the thousands of lead service lines will be a huge expense. By some estimates, between $300 and $400 million. But he says the city should have been more proactive with the problem.
I guess I understand those limitations, but it's also, I have to question, why was it allowed to get to this level?
That's a question Allegheny County Controller Chelsea Wagner has been asking. She says lead has become like a hot potato between the various state and local agencies with a hand in Pittsburgh's water.
You have city officials, you have county officials, all different levels, just pointing their fingers in a million different directions, but no one actually getting down to the real work and doing the hard work. I'm not saying any of this is easy, but it's very, very doable.
She thinks the city's water authority is overestimating how much it would cost to replace all of its lead pipes. Wagner calculates that the city, which had its largest surplus in years in 2016, could replace its lead lines in 5 years.
That's why I get so incredibly frustrated, because it is very, very fixable. What we're just lacking is the will to do it.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto says that's not true. The city has given out close to 20,000 pitchers with lead filters in them. And he's trying to get a state law passed that will allow the water authority to replace private lead lines, with the homeowner paying a share of the cost. Peduto says the next round of lead testing due by the end of the year is likely to comply with EPA limits. And when that happens, PWSA won't be required to remove any more of its lead pipes. But Peduto says the water authority is planning to go ahead with a 10 to 12 year plan to remove those pipes, even if it isn't required by law.
To be honest, the system is antiquated, and it won't get better. We may be able to treat it, but the long-term solution is to completely remove lead pipes from our water system.
Kevin Edmondson's house is among those whose water lines were recently dug up. He's on the porch of his house with his two grandchildren, Dream and Kiersey.
You like to play? Yeah. Eat what?
Cereal.
The day the Water Authority's digging crew came to his street last week was the first time he'd heard about lead.
That's all I know. It's not good for you. You know, I hear lead, it's like, okay, I'm out of here.
As it turns out, the private side of the pipe on his house is copper, and the public side is lead. So the Water Authority will be able to replace its lead pipe.
I'm excited for them to be changing it, though. You know, to keep my family safe. You know, I don't drink tap water, but, you know, say I use water in other ways, you know.
Edmondson, as it turns out, is lucky. Thousands of Pittsburghers will have to wait years to have their lead lines replaced. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
So because of the recent news and the confusion over service lines, a lot of Pittsburgh residents are worried about lead in their water. Then there's the potential for lead exposure through paint in homes built before 1978. How do you know if you or your family are being exposed? Well, a summer youth employment program is trying to help one Pittsburgh neighborhood figure it out. I joined them for a training session where Marcus Poindexter is sitting across a table from four teenagers looking for a nod of agreement.
Hand over the survey to them, right?
He's a doctoral student at the University of Pittsburgh. And this summer, he's the research coordinator for Youth Enrichment Services, or YES.
And say, answer questions that pertain to your household.
Poindexter is practicing a sort of script with high school students in the program, like 17-year-old Keith Jameson. Their mission is to educate Pittsburgh's Lincoln-Lemington neighborhood about lead and get residents to fill out a survey about lead exposure.
What if they don't want to take the survey?
If they say no to the survey, how can we then increase their awareness of sources of lead.
In that case, the students have pamphlets about lead in paint and household dust provided by the Allegheny County Health Department. Officials there met with the teenagers and helped craft the survey questions.
I feel like students add an element to research that is missing. They bring their natural curiosity, they bring their energy, and I think that they actually have a better understanding of the community than some researchers do.
Lincoln Lemington is a mostly African American community, and many of the students in the YES program live there or close by. Plus, Poindexter says people are just more likely to talk to kids. About 20 students chose this lead education and community outreach track from other summer jobs available through YES. Some are mapping housing stock, determining which sections of the neighborhood are most likely to have older homes with lead paint. Others are investigating where people in the community get their information. The group even traveled together to Flint, Michigan, to learn about the disproportionate impact that lead is having on communities of color.
I'm not going to lie, I knew about some of the dangers of lead, but not really into too depth. So it's like cool going home to my mom, like, I know this.
16-year-old Anissa Reed is one of the students hitting the pavement, engaging residents, starting with her mom, who she lives with in nearby Highland Park.
I didn't want to scare her about the situation, but I know it's important, so I kind of did.
She has a little sister at home and knows kids under 6 are most at risk for lead exposure and its consequences, developmental delays and behavior problems. Later, as Reed, Keith Jamison, and their classmate Michaela Dixon knock on front doors in the hot sun, they're hoping to talk to the parents or grandparents of young children. Lincoln Lemington resident Sakina Harris and her little dog, Queen, are home and willing to take the survey.
Hi.
How you doing, baby?
I'm good.
Good.
I'm Michaela Dixon. Do you have any children that reside with you under the age of 6?
No.
Okay, so then you'll just start with section 1.
But she has an older daughter.
I absolutely would like my lead tested, my water tested, but I really never was never concerned to me. Maybe it should have been.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome so much. You guys have a good day.
You too.
So how'd it go?
I think it went pretty good. She completed the survey, and I got to help her out. It's cool.
And also dog as well.
Yeah.
That's extra points for that. The dog is cute. The lady said, like, she knew about it, but didn't pay that much attention. And it goes to show you, like, they're not really giving us what we need, the information for us to be educated and to live healthy and thrive in our own communities. Yeah.
Denise Jones is program director for YES. She says they want students to feel empowered to create change from within their own community and to see research as a potential career.
We're really testing a theory here. Can students really engage in addressing community issues and feel as though their contribution to the challenge or the problem is heard and is valued?
Jones says the students will evaluate the completed surveys and turn them over to the Allegheny County Health Department. Dave Namey heads the health department's housing and community environment program.
I think it's great. I think that what we're going to get out of it is we're going to be able to understand a little better what people know in the neighborhood about lead and develop strategies to further mitigate risk for children.
Namey says they're looking to identify other neighborhoods in the county where community leaders, maybe even kids, could help get the word out about the dangers of lead. We have more coverage about lead, how to manage it in your home, and test your pipes and garden soil for lead. It's all at AlleghenyFront.org/hiddenpoison. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Hey, maybe you've heard about that solar eclipse everyone is talking about. Our region won't get to experience the total darkness of the moon passing between the Earth and the sun, but if you have a good pair of solar glasses,
what you will see is the moon's silhouette taking a bite out of the sun, and you'll see it cover about 3/4 of the sun and then start to move off again.
Hey, it's something. Later on the Allegheny Front, more about the much-anticipated solar eclipse. President Trump likes fossil fuels. He certainly hasn't been shy about his affection for miners and the coal industry, which he's promised to revive. But he's not as fond of renewable energy. Trump and other Republicans have criticized Democrats for giving renewables too sweet a deal. Congress recently let a tax credit for wind installation lapse. But is the momentum in the market and all the gains that renewable energy made under Obama Trump-proof? For our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with someone who's been following that question, Varun Sivaram, the Philip D. Reed Fellow for Science and Technology at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Okay, so I wanted to start with an overview of where the renewable energy industry is. It seems like for years, I mean, since I was a kid, we've always been told that, you know, solar energy and windmills were kind of this utopian clean energy future, but it just hasn't seemed to happen until recently. Solar panels have been around since the 70s. Windmills have been around forever. But it's only now they're really contributing serious portions to the electric grid. I looked some numbers up. In 2008, they contributed about 1%, wind and solar did, of the electricity in the U.S. This year, they've reached 10%. So how would you characterize where this industry is right now?
I would say that both the wind and the solar industry have kind of come of age in the United States and around the world. Just to give some more specific numbers, in the United States, wind power generates a little less than 6% of the United States' electricity. Solar power is around 1%. But the progress made just in the last decade has been remarkable. Wind was kind of first out of the gate, but solar recently has been the one making the most gains. And just in 2016, in many parts of the world, solar became the cheapest form of electricity on the planet, even cheaper in many cases than coal power or natural gas power. I think that, just as you said, solar panels have been around for many decades. In fact, the first solar cell was invented in 1954. But they've only recently come of age as the cost of a solar panel has dropped 70% just since 2010.
To the extent that they've taken off, why? What has happened that's made them more cost competitive with other types of energy?
The initial push for solar happened because developed countries like Germany provided a lot of public incentives and subsidies to deploy solar power. Chinese manufacturers really took advantage of that. They ramped up production. And once Chinese manufacturers did that, they managed to drive the cost down considerably. So we can say that the initial boost towards solar came thanks to taxpayers in countries like Germany. Now that this ball is rolling down the hill and has gathered momentum, costs continue to plunge even though rich countries are pulling back their subsidies. Germany, for example, is slashing its subsidies for solar power. And so even though subsidies are falling, the scale of solar panel production is increasing and the scale of solar panel deployment in projects around the world is increasing. And that's driving down costs even further in a virtuous cycle.
I want to go back to that cost question and China. There was a recent report from Reuters about the potential tariffs that the Trump administration could pose on Chinese solar panels. Can you explain this and what impact this could have on renewables in the United States?
Absolutely. So this has its roots back in the late 2000s when the Chinese government offered loans and loan guarantees to Chinese manufacturers of solar panels. These were, in fact, subsidies to their domestic producers, allowing them to produce solar panels well below the cost that it took to make them. And as a result, the United States and Europe in 2011 and 2012 and 2013 filed cases at the WTO alleging that China had dumped solar panels on the market. The effect of that dumping, by the way, was to put both German and American producers out of business. And many Silicon Valley firms with innovative new technologies also went out of business around that time. Now, the United States and Europe succeeded in winning their trade cases and then put countervailing tariffs, raising the price of Chinese imports into the European Union and the United States. But what China did, or what their companies did, was to shift production to other countries, for example, Malaysia, that wouldn't be hit with these tariffs. Now, most recently, a solar producer called Suniva has come and said that they're still not able to compete with solar panel imports from, for example, Malaysia. And therefore, they're asking the Trump administration to impose a tariff on all solar panels that enter the United States that are made out of silicon, which is the dominant technology accounting for about 90% market share. And if this happens, it's really going to significantly raise the price of solar panels coming into the United States. So if the price of solar panels rises in the United States, that will really undercut the economics, especially of large-scale, or what we call utility-scale, solar projects, big solar farms out in the desert. These solar farms, you know, have very low margins. They really need low cost if they're going to make back the upfront cost of building them by selling their power. And because they're selling their power quite cheaply, if the cost of the solar panel rises, they won't be able to make their money back. And as a result, investors are not going to want to invest in them. So long story short, if the trade case succeeds, what that would mean is that the deployment of solar power in the United States would fall sharply.
Do you think that's a realistic option? Do you think he would actually do that?
It's really hard to tell. It would be a terrible idea, in my opinion, and from the perspective of trying to increase the amount of solar power in the United States. But the Trump administration has been very clear that they intend to push a Buy America doctrine. And so if there's a way for them to make it easier for American manufacturers to produce panels by making foreign panels from every single country, not just China, more expensive, there is a possibility that they go ahead and do this. And the possibility is being recognized by markets and investors. And that's why there was a slowdown in investment. Now, I don't think this is a good idea for a few reasons. First, the United States has committed to reduce its emissions. President Trump has pledged to pull out of the Paris Agreement, but he hasn't yet. He's not allowed to until 2020. And right now, we are bound under an international commitment to reduce our emissions. And it's going to be a lot harder to do that if we can't deploy solar power at the rate we've already been doing. Second, in the effort to protect local manufacturing jobs by raising the price of imported panels, I think President Trump is going about this the wrong way. The right way to encourage a domestic industry in the United States is to encourage industries that are innovative, industries that play to our strengths as the most innovative economy on Earth. That doesn't mean raising the price of your competitors' products. That means supporting companies that make even better products. And I think that advanced manufacturing of solar panels, brand new technologies, for example, could be an engine of job growth. This trade action is not going to encourage companies to pursue such revolutionary technologies. It's really just going to encourage them to try and make tried and true old-fashioned solar panels because the competition just got a lot more expensive.
Varun Sivaram is the Philip D. Reed Fellow for Science and Technology at the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier for our podcast, Trump on Earth. And you can hear more of the interview at trumponearth.org. Trump on Earth is a co-production with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. And if you like it, or if you have suggestions for upcoming episodes, let us know on Twitter, at Trump on Earth. It's almost here. The Great American Eclipse. On Monday, a ribbon of land from the west coast of Oregon to the east coast of South Carolina will experience a total eclipse of the sun. It's the first total solar eclipse in the continental U.S. since 1979. WPSU's Christine Allen consulted some local astronomers to find out what the fuss is all about.
Retired astronomer Bill Arden has master's degrees in physics and astronomy, and he spent 5 years doing research on the sun. He keeps his telescope out in the yard of his home in rural central Pennsylvania. It's housed on a tripod in its own observatory, complete with a domed roof that slides open.
Let me open it.
It's tiny. It looks like a kid's playhouse.
That's my man cave. It's about 8 feet across, holds the telescope nicely.
The observatory is made from PVC, most of it recycled plastic, Arden says. And a solar panel provides the power to adjust the telescope.
Under the three legs of the tripod, there's a block of concrete.
Why is that important?
That isolates the tripod and the telescope from the deck. And so you can dance on the deck and the telescope never feels it.
You have to have quite a fascination with the stars to have this kind of setup in your yard. So I wasn't surprised to hear that Arden's planning to travel to see Monday's total eclipse of the sun.
This will be my first one, which is why I'm driving halfway across the country to see it.
Since Pennsylvania will only experience a partial eclipse, Arden will head to Nebraska to visit family and watch the total eclipse.
From what you know about eclipses, what will this experience be like?
You really won't see much of anything until totality hits. So if you look at the sun through a pair of good solar glasses or a good solar filter, you'll see the moon's shadow take a bite out of the sun. It will get progressively larger.
But you won't notice any change in the light just yet, Arden says.
In other words, the sun can be 80 or 90% blocked and you won't see any difference. But in the seconds before totality, actually, if you're in a big, open, clear space, you'll actually see the shadow of the moon coming toward you. It'll be like a fast-moving thunderstorm.
Then suddenly it will get dark.
Dark enough that birds stop singing, the cicadas start to chirp, nighttime things start to happen.
But that nightfall, Arden says, is short-lived.
That lasts for, depending on where you are, 2 minutes and 40 seconds or something like that. And then it goes back to being normal daylight again. So we're all going halfway across the country for 2.5 minutes.
Chances are most of the eclipse photos you've seen show the corona of the sun encircling the dark disk of the moon. But Arden says that may not be exactly how the corona will look during this solar eclipse.
We're almost at solar minimum. The sunspot cycle is about 11 years long, and we go from very few sunspots to a peak of lots of sunspots, typically hundreds at a time, during solar maximum.
And a lack of sunspots, Arden says, means the corona may look very different.
If you looked at the corona during solar maximum, you'd see arcs and loops and streamers and things pointing out all sorts of directions from the sun. The field settles down a lot at solar minimum. And so at solar minimum, if you look at the corona, it's very likely that what you'll see is just two long tapered streamers, one coming out each side of the sun around the solar equator.
That's what you'll see if you're traveling south or west from Pennsylvania into the path of the total eclipse on Monday. But if you stay and watch the partial eclipse?
If you've got a decent pair of solar glasses, you can look directly at the sun, and what you will see is the moon's silhouette taking a bite out of the sun. And you'll see it cover about 3/4 of the sun at the point where totality is south of you, and then start to move off again. You won't see the darkness of totality, but you definitely can see the bite out of the sun.
Meanwhile, at Penn State University, astronomer Chris Palma plans to stay in central Pennsylvania for the eclipse.
Millions of people are planning to travel to somewhere along that path to see the eclipse. There's a lot of worry that traffic is going to be pretty serious on that day.
Palma says he thought about traveling with some of his colleagues to see the total eclipse, but decided to stay and watch the partial eclipse in Pennsylvania.
The more I thought about it, there's going to be thousands of students here at Penn State who are going to want to see the partial solar eclipse. So I'm organizing a group of us to be on campus and in the community, handing out eclipse glasses so that people can safely observe the eclipse while it happens.
Let's talk about observing this safely.
Yes. Yes, safety should be on all of our minds. You know, some people are thinking, oh, I'll just put on some heavy sunglasses I have. Those will not be safe either. Please do go outside. Just don't look directly at the sun without solar glasses that you know are safe.
If you can't get outside to view the eclipse or you don't have special eclipse glasses, you can, of course, watch the live stream online, courtesy of NASA.
They have a great website that's very easy to find that brings together all of their 2017 eclipse information in one place, and that's where they'll be live streaming it. And so that's where I would go, is NASA's main eclipse website.
If you miss the eclipse altogether, take heart. On April 8th, 2024, there will be another total solar eclipse. The path of totality for that eclipse will cross the northwest corner of Pennsylvania, stretching from Titusville to Erie. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Christine Allen.
Thanks to WPSU and State College for that story. And thanks for listening to this week's show. If you're looking for me on Monday, I'll probably be here trying to borrow someone else's solar shades. There's more about the eclipse and all of this week's stories at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.